Hello, everyone. My name is Reese Karlinski, and this is Young History, episode 161 on Iraq. The capital of this nation is Baghdad, and Iraq was known as Mesopotamia throughout most of its history, which means between two rivers, referring to its location between the two rivers, the Euphrates and Tigris River. The name Iraq likely comes from the old Arabic term Araga, which meant well-watered or deeply rooted. The name could also be an adaptation of the word Uruk, which was the name of an ancient Sumerian city. It could also be the Persian term Irag, which means lowland. All of these would make sense because Mesopotamia, the region now encompassing Iraq, is often referred to as the cradle of civilization for its fertility. It is where some of the earliest complex societies and urban centers emerged and laid the foundation for pretty much every aspect of modern civilization. Some other facts are that Iraq hosts annual date festivals showcasing the country's date production, meaning the fruit, and it promotes Iraqi dates to domestic and international buyers. The festival aims to boost the export of dates and highlight their cultural and economic significance to Iraq. The Ziggurat of Ur, located near the modern-day city of Nasiriyah in southern Iraq, is one of the best-preserved ziggurats, which is an ancient Mesopotamian stepped pyramid, in the world. This one dates back to the 21st century BC and was dedicated to the moon god Nanna. The city of Erbil, also known as Arbil or Irbil, in the Kurdistan region of Iraq, is often regarded as one of the oldest continuous inhabited cities in the world. It has been inhabited for at least 8,000 years continuously. In the southern marshlands of Iraq, there exists a unique culture of people known as the Marsh Arabs or Matan. They live in reed houses and rely on fishing, water buffalo husbandry, and agriculture in the marshes to fuel their distinct way of life. And that pretty much gets us to the start. I don't want to dilly-dally anymore. As you can imagine with the cradle of civilization, there's going to be a lot of history to get through here. So definitely buckle in, get ready for this, and this is going to be fun. So as always, I'm very glad you guys are here. And this is definitely a country that gets a bad rep in different parts of the media. But there's a lot of history to cover to explain why it's gotten to the place it is. So I implore you to watch it, and I am very glad you're here. I also commend you for it. Nonetheless, I'm yapping, even though I said I wouldn't. But my name is Rich Harlinski. This is Young History, and this is Iraq. Hope you guys enjoy. Our origins begin at the period we stated with Erbil, which is clearly one of the oldest inhabited places in the world, having people here for at least the past 8,000 years. So this is also when we mark the start of Iraq's history. The region where Mesopotamia arises is regarded as the first place traceable human civilization ever was. Sumer was the first great civilization. It formed just before 4000 BC and lasted almost 2,000 years, making it all the way into the 1900s BC. They didn't leave behind any major records, but they left behind a lot of handmade art, sculptures, and clay tablets used for storytelling with cuneiform symbolic writing. The tablets were created by carving shapes and symbols into the tablet. Once they were done, they would bake it till it was hard, which gave us the term hard copy. Sumerians built cities like Uruk and Ur, then invented the wheel and early writing. Sumerians spoke a language isolate, which means its roots were found nowhere else in the world. One of the legendary stories of the Sumerians is the story of Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh was part god and part man that attempted to find eternal life. The Sumerians built large tributary steps to honor him and many other deities, and they called them ziggurats. Akkadians conquered Sumer around 2350 BC under the leadership of Sargon of Akkad. Sumerian culture was extremely strong and artistic, so the Akkadians actually adopted it fully. Naram-Sin was the ruler of the Golden Age period of the Akkadian Empire, and he led it to its zenith from 2254 to 2218. Assyria and Babylonia rose as powerful kingdoms out of the cities of Assur and Babylon. The Old Assyrian Empire formed in 2025 BC and lasted all the way until 1378 BC. The kingdom was very reliant on trade, which made it one of the most influential powers in its time. There was also the Amorites, which were a Levantine people group that moved into the city of Babylon. In 1894, the old Babylonian Empire was created. This empire would last until 1595 BC. King Hammurabi led the old Babylonian kingdom from 1792 BC to 1750 BC. His rule was based mostly on an expansion which connected Babylon to the Persian Gulf. This expansion was achieved by defeating the Assyrians in order to take full control of Mesopotamia. Once Babylonian rule was established, the Hammurabi Codes were engaged. They were one of the first legal codes in the entire world to be accepted by a greater area of one region. As per usual, the leadership of a strong monarch was followed by very weak leadership. The old Babylonian kingdom started to decline and left it vulnerable to invasion. In 1596 BC, the Hittites invaded from the west and conquered most of western Mesopotamia. Around the same time, the Kassites moved in from the east to conquer the other part of Mesopotamia. The Middle Assyrian Empire rose up in 1392 BC after a lot of systemic development allowed the Assyrians to unite once again. This empire lasted until 935 BC. Now, Assyria became a very marginalized state and sought to expand its power as often as it could. But nonetheless, the region still faced the Late Bronze Age collapse, which occurred between 1200 and 1150 BC. These unexpected and overall unexplained collapses brought down the great civilizations of this era, including the Middle Assyrian Empire. Once the empire fell, the semi-nomadic Aramaeans and Chaldeans moved into the land. The Aramaeans brought Aramaic writing, which became the lingua franca across the Middle East for its relative ease to learn. Back in Babylon, the Kassite dynasty of Babylon ruled from 1595 to 1155 BC. The Kassites attempted to be expansive and revolutionary leaders in the region, but constant invasions and clashes at the borders made this very hard. In the 1100s, the Elamites of Elam overran the Kassites from the east. Then the Neo-Assyrian Empire was founded in 911 BC. This time, the Assyrians wanted to establish dominant control of the region. Invasions were led across the entire Middle East, and the Neo-Assyrian Empire connected the Mediterranean Sea to the Gulf of Persia. Strict laws based on the subordination were enacted across the Assyrian territory. Anyone that resisted the rule of the Assyrians faced brutal punishment, such as being burned alive or skinned. Shalmaneser III was a legendary king of this Assyrian period that ruled from 859 to 824 BC. He continued the expansionist and military efforts of the Neo-Assyrians, and he named himself the King of All Peoples. Then there was Tiglath-Pileser III, who ruled from 745 to 727 BC. He was most famous for leading the invasion that conquered Babylon. One of his successors was Sennacherib, who ruled from 1705 to 681 BC. He is most famous for being the Assyrian leader that destroyed Babylon. He used the resources from destroyed Babylon to beautify the capital of the Neo-Assyrian Empire called Nineveh. Esarhaddon ruled from 681 to 669. He built Babylon and expanded Assyrian rule across Egypt. Then another great king was Ashurbanipal, who ruled from 669 to 631 BC. He is known as a scholarly king because he built a great library that held many Assyrian manuscripts and artifacts that helped us understand the history of the empire. As a captain is meant to go down with his ship, Ashurbanipal's rule ended with Assyria itself. In 631, many local powers combined their strength to invade the Assyrian capital. The Battle of Nineveh occurred and Assyria fell forever. Nabopolassar was a leader of the Babylonian forces during the fall of Assyria. Once Assyria's presence had officially been eradicated, he ascended to a position of power and created the Neo-Babylonian Empire. This empire remained in power from 626 BC until 539 BC. Nabopolassar ruled the empire from 626 until 605, and he was succeeded by Nebuchadnezzar, who ruled from 605 to 562 BC. Nebuchadnezzar had a very lengthy reign that caused the golden age of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. He is noted as the ruler that created the famous blue walls and massive capital at Babylon. He is also recognized as the leader that commissioned the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which were once one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. I bet you can guess what I'm going to say now. Just like always, the strong leader was followed by a series of weak leaders, which led them to decline and led the entire nation to fall apart. By 550 BC, the Neo-Babylonian Empire was spread thin and weakened, which left it very vulnerable. It would be in this year that the Achaemenid Persians would invade under Cyrus the Great. Achaemenid rule would last from 550 to 330 BC and would end when Alexander the Great led his huge conquest across the Middle East in the 330s BC. Greek rule was established at that point and it lasted until 247 BC. And I know I'm giving you guys a lot of just date, but it's good to understand the scale and chronology of what happens in Mesopotamia / Iraq because it just goes so far back. Nonetheless, in the year 247 BC, the Parthian Empire united the power of the Persians and conquered Mesopotamia. The empire remained in power all the way until 224 CE. The Roman Empire rose to become the most dominant power in the world by 117 CE. By this point, Roman rule had expanded all the way to Mesopotamia because Emperor Trajan expanded Rome to the peak of its territory. By the end of the 100 CE, the majority of Assyrian people had converted to Christianity. Sassanid Persia rose to dominance in the region around 224 CE because the Roman Empire had stretched itself very thin. Sassanid Persia dominated the region until 651 CE. Persian art, language, and culture found a great home here and remained present for centuries to come. The Rashidun Caliphate became the first Arabic-led power to dominate the region. They spread their influence across the Middle East at 632 BC and introduced Islam. The new religion found a great home here and became the dominant religion all the way until the modern age. Arabic also replaced Aramaic as the lingua franca across the region. And then there was the Abbasid Caliphate. It expanded across the region in 750 and dominated it all the way until 1258 CE. The 800s and 900s are considered the Islamic Golden Age. It was during this time that the great city of Baghdad was constructed. In the city, there would be hundreds of thousands of manuscripts containing practices, historical documents, and other relevant material that shaped what Mesopotamian culture left behind for the rest of the world. During this time, Arab scholars shared information with Greeks, Jews, and other people in the area to have a better grasp on science, philosophy, math, and the different perspectives of the world. The contributions of all these people furthered the advancement of society in the Middle East and in the West. Many of the documents or teachings transferred during this period can still be found in Baghdad today. The place they were stored was the Bat al-Hikmah, which was the Grand Historical Library of Baghdad. And during this period, there was also great philosophers and scientists, such as al-Khwarizmi, who was a mathematician of the 700s that made great advancements in understanding algebraic form. There was al-Kindi, who was a great Arabic philosopher of the 800s that is the father of Arab philosophy. Al-Tabari was a religious interpreter of the same time period that gave deep analysis of the Quran and established the Muslim culture in Iraq. Ibn al-Haytham was a scientist that is considered the father of optics. He is the creator of vision theory, which is the proposed explanation of how information crosses the space between the perceiver and what is being looked at. His early teachings were the basis for modern optical science. However, it must be acknowledged that the only reason the Abbasid Caliphate had so much time and wealth to achieve such great things was because nobody was working in the labor force. North Africans and black people in the Middle East were enslaved heavily and called Zanj, and were used as slave labor to build up the great nation. However, the Zanj Rebellion was the first major slave uprising that occurred in the Arabic world. It happened from 869 to 883. The decades-long revolt was bloody and caused divisions in the Abbasid sphere of influence. The Abbasids would continue to decline because of the Seljuk Turks in the east. They started to expand their territory more and more and put a lot of pressure on the Abbasids. Constant battles with the Turks and other great powers left Baghdad weakened and divided. The vulnerability of Baghdad revealed itself in 1258, because this was when the Mongol invasion occurred. Genghis Khan led the siege of Baghdad. The enormous Mongol force stormed Baghdad and killed thousands of people. Mosques, shrines, and the great historical library were all destroyed as Baghdad was nearly burnt to the ground. The horrendous yet legendary saying about this time was that the Tigris River flowed black with the ink of a thousand lost stories. Even after the invasion ended, Baghdad and the greater area struggled with the hunger, plague, and poverty that came from widespread instability and quality of life diminishing. In the wake of the suffering that followed the Mongol invasion, the region made no progress. The very little bit of recovery that was made got wiped away very quickly because of Timur or Tamerlane. Tamerlane was a Turkic-Mongol descendant of Genghis Khan that wanted to reestablish a powerful empire under his control. He invaded Baghdad in 1401. Tamerlane is regarded as even more brutal than Genghis Khan and the Mongols. This was proven in the aftermath of the invasion of Baghdad because Tamerlane allegedly created 120 towers made from beheaded Baghdad citizens. Tamerlane also had a specific vendetta against Christianity because he felt it was a false religion. So, he nearly eliminated every single member of the Assyrian church in the east, which means that he killed nearly every single Christian in the Middle East. Destroyed and divided, this region became a battlefield between the Safavid Persians and the Ottoman Empire. In 1639, the Ottomans established victory and took control of the region with the Treaty of Zuhab. The Ottomans were led by Sultan Murad IV, who became the de facto leader of Iraq. In the first era of Ottoman rule, there was almost nothing done in Mesopotamia. The land was destroyed, the population was small, and the only thing that kept the people of the region going was the small amount of trades they could do with local resources like dates. The Ottomans established vilayets, which are kind of like provinces, and there was a lot of migration into the different vilayets of Mesopotamia, mainly by Gulf Arabs. The land that was made into Iraq was comprised of three Ottoman vilayets, specifically Baghdad, Basra, and Mosul. Now we're going to jump to World War I, because as I said, there was very little done in that early part of Ottoman rule, and despite it getting conquered, back in 1639, Iraq just had this happen. There was a development of culture influenced by the Persians that had stuck around for hundreds of years. However, the Ottomans tried to challenge this and push it out. The Ottomans eliminated different cultural practices and tried to push more Turkic culture and religious influence into the region. Turkish, that is, not Turkic. And with all that, they tried to limit what it meant to be a member of this area. But of course, they were not trying to limit what it meant to be Iraqi, because being Iraqi did not exist yet. That happens very soon. So nonetheless, we get to World War One. The region was dragged into the war because of the Ottoman alliance with Germany. The Allies would make their march during the Mesopotamian campaign, which lasted from 1914 to 1918. The British campaign was successful, and they took full control over the area once the Ottomans were ousted from power. The British established the Mandate for Mesopotamia. It placed the Mesopotamian vilayets under the British control. The new nation was then led by Sir Percy Fox. The nation, which was made up of three vilayets, many ethnic groups, and a lot of cultural diversity, was united into one political unit that today is Iraq. The many different people that lived in what was now called Iraq did not stand for this odd unity. So, the Iraq Revolt began in 1920. Both Shia and Sunni nationals fought as one to change the system. The Kurds, which are a major Iranian ethnic group that have been stateless for over a century, also revolted against the mandate. Mahmoud Barzanji united the Kurdish force, which started the Mahmoud Barzanji revolts. These Kurdish independence revolts lasted from 1919 until 1924. A significant percentage of the Kurds claimed to be descendants of the ancient Medes peoples. The British suppressed both rebellions. However, in order to appease the people, more autonomy was given to Iraq. And the whole issue with this was that being Iraqi didn't exist. There was no Iraqis. There was no Iraq. It was just different people in this area that had completely different history, different religious views, and just different history being grouped into one thing and called Iraqi by the British. And the legacy of that is still present today, which we'll see very soon, but that's the reason there is the Iraq Revolt and the Kurdish Revolts, because there just isn't anything to unite these people. They're not the same group. It's, I don't know, to give perspective, it'd be like if you took people from Texas, New York, and Wyoming, put them in a small town and said all of you have to be governed by the exact same type of person, and it's actually going to be a person from only one of your ethnic groups. So, ethnic groups is a stretch, but you know what I mean, one of your groups. Nonetheless, it's just super weird and it just doesn't make sense. It's not something that's set up for success at all. And we're going to see that very soon. Faisal I was an Arabic prince of the Hashemite dynasty, and he was installed as a king by the British. His rule lasted from 1921 until 1933. However, the Hashemites still rule Iraq to this day. Independence was officially achieved in 1932, but British influence was still prominent in Iraq. Decades after independence, there was still a lot of Western pull in Iraqi politics, and this came to an end with the July 14th Revolution. This occurred in 1958. The revolution overthrew the monarch in power. Abd al-Karim Qasim was a military officer that led the revolution and became the head of state once he formed the Republic of Iraq. He was very pro-Iraqi nationalism. He took the land of the British Iraq Petroleum Company and made it into the Iraq National Oil Company. He wanted to unite a Kurdish state across the Middle East, and his actions in pursuit of this caused a strain in relations between Middle East and Iraq. Eventually, Qasim caused a lot of divisions with his own party because of how radically he supported his own ideas. Eventually, there was so much opposition that a full-on revolution was brewing. The Ramadan Revolution occurred in 1963. The revolution pushed Qasim out of power. The revolution was led by ultra-nationalist and socialist group called the Ba'ath Party. The Ba'ath killed Qasim and took power nationwide. General Abdul Salam Arif took power, but shortly after he died and was replaced by his brother, Abdul Rahman Arif. However, even the second Arif brother was unable to hold power, and he was also killed and replaced by the Ba'ath Party favorite, Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr. Qasim's ideas of a stoutly nationalist Iraq left a party that was ready to prioritize expansion and an economic focus for Iraq. Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr was in office from 1968 to 1979. The economy under Bakr was strong because oil sales shot through the roof. The new access to large amounts of economic wealth caused the living standards to improve across Iraq and led to other quality of life improvements. The oil boom went hand in hand with a population boom, so Iraq became the second most wealthy Arab state behind Saudi Arabia with a young, growing population. The boom continued from the late 60s through most of the 80s. The Ba'ath Party was very repressive of the Kurds because they ran such an Arab nationalist government. The Kurds were consistently repressed, and the northern part of Iraq where they lived continued to be underdeveloped. The Kurdish Democratic Party formed to represent the Kurds, but They matched the aggressive nationalism of the Ba'ath Party with aggressive acts of resistance, which some may see as terrorism. This made the Kurds the stout enemy of the Ba'ath, and they would be targeted very soon. At this same point, there was Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was a revolutionary in the 1963 coup. He was also the head of the internal security and a shrewd politician for the Ba'ath Party. He became vice president of the country for his popularity, which he gained through representing Iraq well and advocating for all things pro-Iraq nationalism. Even when Bakr was president, it became clear that most decisions were made for the country by Saddam Hussein. Hussein also kept the citizens in check no matter what it took. This occurred just barely after the Iranian Revolution. This was done because the Iranian Revolution, significant crackdowns were made onto the population of Iraq because the Iranian Revolution seemed to pose a threat to Iraq's sovereignty. The pressure of the situation actually caused Bakr to step down and Hussein to become the official leader of the country. One of the first orders Saddam Hussein gave caused the Ba'ath Party purge in 1979. The Ba'ath Party purge occurred because Saddam did not want his people getting the same revolutionary urge that swept across Iran. He believed that there was an underlying plot to oust him from power by the Ba'ath Party. So he repressed their rights and enacted the purge, which eliminated most political opponents. He gathered many political officials and listed off the ones he saw as opponents. If a name was called, the person was effectively executed. Saddam Hussein began to isolate Iraq from all other nations and make a personal enemy out of Iran. Reactions to this, plus other geopolitical factors, led Saddam Hussein to order the invasion of Iran, thus beginning the Iran-Iraq War, which was fought from 1980 to 1988. Many factors led to the start of the war, including the extreme divide between Sunni and Shia Islam, extreme nationalists in Iraq, geopolitical issues over the Khuzestan region that was filled with oil, and more all caused the war. Hussein and his cabinet also claimed that an invasion from Iran was imminent, so their attack was quote-unquote preemptive. Iraq pushed into Iran very consistently for 2 months, and then they got into a six-year stalemate. During these 6 years, Iraq developed different chemical weapons to use on the war front. These chemical weapons did sway the war towards Iraq, but Iran still defended itself very well. For 8 years, this brutal war was fought to a standstill. Nearly 1 million Iraqi soldiers and civilians died, and many others were tortured or injured. The infrastructure of Iraq was destroyed, and the nation lost a lot of oil fields in the war. The economy was in shambles, and Iraq was in a very dark time. One of the worst cases that came from the war was the Halabj chemical attacks of 1988. Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi forces were accused of using chemical weapons on civilian areas, especially those with a Kurdish population. This made Iraq very unpopular on an international level. This same period also saw the Ba'ath Party enact more attacks on the Kurdish north. In 1986 and 1989, Hussein and the Ba'ath Party ordered the depopulation of the Kurdish north. Nearly 190,000 Kurds were tortured, killed, or forcibly disappeared. This is widely regarded as a genocide and not an act of war by all sources outside of Iraq. Hussein justified this by saying that they were challenging Iraq and would eventually pose a threat. Another step in that whole "we're doing this preemptively" thing. Iraq also had to deal with a regional issue. A lot of the funding for the Iraq-Iran war came because of the large loans from Kuwait. Kuwait was extremely oil-rich at the time and was not involved in the conflict, but was willing to loan out billions of dollars to Iraq. After the war, the instability of Iraq made it unable to pay off the huge amount it owed Kuwait. Kuwait was very resistant to the idea of giving Iraq any economic forgiveness. This created tensions between the two. Tensions got even worse when Iraq accused Kuwait of using a diagonal drilling method to siphon oil out of Iraq. All this culminated into the invasion of Kuwait in 1990. Iraq took power in Kuwait rather quickly because there was almost no real resistance met. The invasion and occupation caused international outrage, and Saddam Hussein was ordered to withdraw his forces from Kuwait. Saddam refused, and the backlash was unprecedented. The United States led a coalition of 42 allied nations against Iraq in the Gulf War. The war lasted only a year. The United States strategized Operation Desert Storm, which was a full-scale invasion, including bombing campaigns, airstrikes, and more across Iraq. The Iraqi troops were kicked out of Kuwait, but despite their defeat, they got one last spiteful achievement. During the Iraqi retreat, the troops set hundreds of oil wells in Kuwait on fire. Iraq was battered, widely damaged, and even more economically poor than before the war. On top of this, the UN launched the Security Council Resolution 687, which was pretty much a package of harsh sanctions that prevented Iraq from exporting oil. The UN also wanted Iraq to completely demilitarize, but the Iraqi civilians and government saw this as an abuse of their sovereignty. Nonetheless, the requests of the UN were still met. Then, in the UN Security Council Resolution 1988, then in the UN Security Council Resolution 986, the Oil for Food program was rolled out. The program encouraged Iraq to sell its oil to the UN member nations in order to get humanitarian aid for their country. Even though Iraq did contribute to the system, the economy of the country did not grow because oil was no longer being traded for real goods or money. And then there was 9/11. It created a jaded and aggressive United States that sought to avenge the loss of its people. U.S. President George W. Bush was convinced in a meeting at Camp David that Saddam Hussein was harboring weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and would be a perfect target for the war on terror. Bush was also convinced that Saddam Hussein was somehow connected to the 9/11 attacks and used both of these points as justification for the 2003 invasion of Iraq and the start of the Iraq War. The invasion was launched in March and Baghdad was taken over by U.S. forces in April. The U.S. established the Coalition Provisional Authority Government in order to control Iraq. By the end of the year, U.S. forces captured Saddam Hussein. Not long after, a court in Iraq ordered his execution and carried it out. The execution happened at Camp Justice, which was a joint Iraqi-U.S. military base. As time rolled on, the truth came out. There was no weapons of mass destruction being harbored by Iraq. The reason this was an issue was because part of the sanctions placed on Iraq after the Gulf War was that it could not harbor large weapons of mass destruction, and any program at this level would be a violation of UN law. The truth then hit the United States. George W. Bush and his cabinet at Camp David were initially against an invasion of Iraq. It was clear to all advisors and U.S. officials at Camp David that the 9/11 attacks were committed by Al-Qaeda of Afghanistan and were likely being harbored in Pakistan. However, there was one person standing on the other side, Paul Wolfowitz. May he burn in hell. He was the Deputy Secretary of Defense. Wolfowitz knew exactly how to get Bush to cooperate with his idea of invading Iraq. Wolfowitz privately spoke to George Bush during a recess at the meeting. In this private conversation, Wolfowitz mentioned the vast amount of oil reserves that were in Iraq. George W. Bush got his start in politics as a Texan oil mogul, and this was a perfect appeal to him. Once the meeting reconvened, both George W. Bush and Wolfowitz stated their claim that an invasion of Iraq was necessary to defend democracy and enhance the war on terror. The Bush administration began sprouting all sorts of propaganda to justify the invasion. First, it was to liberate the Iraqi people. Then it was to bring democracy to the nation. And finally, was the falsified claim that there were weapons of mass destruction being harbored by Saddam Hussein's regime. Reports show that there were over 100 full-scale investigations into the arsenal of Iraq. Every single one of these investigations proved that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction, nor were they having a program to develop them. However, this did not stop George W. Bush, who was clearly set on his path. Slight subterfuge shifted to complete lies when George W. Bush continued to claim that there were investigations proving weapons of mass destruction were in possession of Saddam Hussein. Because of how horrible 9/11 was, George Bush and the U.S. put a lot of pressure on its allies to back any U.S. operation in the Middle East as part of the counterterrorism effort. Close allies like France and the United Kingdom were hesitant to join an invasion of a nation that did not prove to be a threat. Nonetheless, these very close allies did support the invasion, but once the truth came out, all hell broke loose. The lies of the U.S. government became very clear to the European and other allies of the United States. A large wedge was driven between the nations of the EU and the United States. George W. Bush was called a liar by not only the U.S. allies abroad, but also the majority of his citizens. There was pure outrage because the Iraq War killed nearly 30,000 people on the side of the coalition, and hundreds of thousands were wounded. On top of this, not only were there over 100,000 Iraqis killed, but millions of Iraqi citizens were displaced. In Iraq, there was a strong backlash to the U.S. invasion and the execution of Saddam Hussein. Anti-American extremist groups formed. Al-Qaeda caused chaos in the eastern cities. The lack of government caused major uprisings and terrorist attacks from the Kurdish population. The United States remained in Iraq in order to fight against these extremist groups. But then, the U.S. started to commit secretive horrors. Prisoners were tortured and abused by U.S. soldiers in Abu Ghraib. The abuse and torture at Abu Ghraib led to an increase of attacks and resistance from the extremist groups. The U.S. invasion led to nothing but destruction and death for Iraq. The U.S. would remain in Iraq until 2011, when all troops were pulled out. But by that point, at least 20,000 Iraqis had died from direct violence in the U.S. occupation. The Syrian civil war also began in 2011, which is a whole other issue to get into, but I did cover that on episode 138 on Syria. Nonetheless, this civil war caused a huge influx of refugees into Iraq from Syria. This caused a shared struggle to occur between the two people groups and led to the foundation of ISIS, the Islamic State of Israel and Syria. ISIS was a disgusting force that committed nearly genocidal level attacks on the Shia Muslims, the Christians, and the Yazids, which are a Kurdish minority religious group, across this entire region. In 2015, the influence and effects of ISIS began to heavily decline because of the consistent efforts of a U.S.-led coalition, Iraqi resistant forces, and Kurdish fighters. Nonetheless, this year also brought a lot of protests from the Iraqi people, who were tired of suffering through horrendous quality of life in their country. In the years since, the conflict in Syria has caused many immigrants into Iraq and a lot of violence to come from the civil war as well. The divisions between the different parts of Iraq, namely the Kurdish North, the government-controlled capital, and the rural regions that are swarmed with extremist resistance groups, have continued to grow despite a rising peace in the country. Once the U.S. pulled its troops out of the country in 2011, there was also a sharp increase in terror attacks, but there was also a seeming increase in nationalism. The pride of people that had government positions caused there to be increased stability. The economy continued to grow as the wartime era passed. Steady and competitive elections have followed, even though some politics have been influenced by Iran. And all of that brings us to the present, where over 50% of the Iraq population lives at or below the poverty line. The demographics of the nation are scary, because less than 20% of the nation is actually Arab, and the rest is made up of foreign expats that are widely employed as a labor source. On top of this, a large percentage of this labor source is forced and is considered in the count of modern-day slavery. But Iraq's economy has grown year over year over the last half decade. The power struggle for control of the very divided Iraq continues to this day and will be in the spotlight as tensions in the Middle East continue to rise. However, President Latif Rashid claims the nation is widely in peace, which seems to be true to some degree. Iraq is not a war-torn nation like it has been depicted recently in the media. President Rashid hopes that more media companies will focus on the bright sides of Iran, which is the oldest country in the world and has given the world so much influence. And at the end of these, I always like to do a takeaway or mindset, and we are at that point now. So with Iraq, that takeaway slash mindset we can learn from this history is going to be, is stand on where you think you belong and prepare for the long haul. I say that with Iraq because this nation has been inhabited by people, Arabs, different groups for thousands of years, longer than really anywhere else in the world in civilization manner where they came here before they became prominent anywhere else. And despite the wars, colonization from the British, the Ottomans, anybody who came into this region from as far back as the Assyrians to as recently as ISIS and other powers, the Iraqi people, despite that being a weird term to describe the people who have lived here throughout history, have always continued to resist, and they have always continued to plant their feet in their homeland and refuse to leave. No matter what the world has brought to them in manners of war, colonization, invasions, anything, there has always been Iraqi pride. There's always been national pride for the people that live here, and they love where they live. They love their history, and they very well should. They've stood on this land that they've lived on forever and have refused to move, no matter how bad it's gotten, because throughout the 1900s, this country struggled, had its ups, had its downs, but for the last 30 years, this country has been in very deep struggle and continues to be in it to this day because of the lies of the United States and the issues that have occurred in the country. So I say you could apply that to yourself, because whatever your issue is, whatever's going on, it's going to take time. Most things don't go away overnight. Most things aren't as easy as just pressing a button. We all have our addictions. We all have our struggles. We all have our mental lapses. People that are really bad for us but are close to us in our lives. We all have those things. But you need to stand exactly where you need to be. And I mean that both physically, as in stand in the home you believe you should be in, stand firmly on your apartment, whatever that is for you. But I also mean it metaphorically too, in the sense that you should just stand on business and stand on what you believe is right and prepare for the long haul. It is going to be a long time until most things get figured out, but it will get better before it gets worse. And you need to believe that and need to be prepared for whatever comes on the path to that, just like the Iraqi have for thousands of years now, because they have not seen a lot of grace and beautiful moments in their history. They've seen great moments, but they haven't seen great continued periods. There's been a lot of suffering, a lot of invasions, abuse, and that's continued into the modern age. But Iraq still has pride, Iraq still has beautiful history, and it has stood on what it believes is its home and has looked forward to the future and said, I'm ready for whatever comes. So you need to do the same thing. Stand on business, stand on whatever place you need to be in, and look forward to the future and say, I'm ready for whatever comes. So with all that and all of my yapping about different stories and all that, we are at the end. I hope I covered Iraq's history well because it is one of the most ancient and important nations for the development of the world, maybe the single most if you consider all the achievements of Mesopotamia and achievement of Iraq. But nonetheless, that is the end. So I really do hope you guys enjoyed. This one means a lot to me as a historian because I've heard Mesopotamia since I was five, and now being able to dive deep really meant something. So glad you guys are here. And one more time, my name is Reese Karlinski. This is Young History. And that was Iraq.